Work is one of the major parts of our lives, isn't it? A lot of hours of our lives are given to work. And because it's such a major part of our lives, it's not surprising that we hear a lot of different songs in popular culture regarding work. A lot of these songs, of course, are pretty positive. They try to encourage taking responsibility, working hard. But I would say there's probably a lot more that are quite negative when it comes to work. The lyrics to one song from the 60s captures this sentiment, the sentiment of many songs. It says, "Up every morning just to keep a job. I gotta fight my way through the hustling mob. Sounds of the city pounding in my brain. Well, another day goes down the drain." Maybe some of you are humming along with that, I don't know. But that comes from a song way back in the day called 5 O'Clock World. And again, I think it succinctly summarizes the sentiment that many people have toward their work. They feel frustrated with their job. They go to work day after day, and yet they feel day after day just goes down the drain. In other words, work day after grueling day feels like vanity, futility. You do all this toil, but what do you have to show for it at the end of your life? Well, by now in our study through Ecclesiastes, you're probably not surprised to hear that this is kind of how, well, not just kind of how, this is how Solomon feels about work. Now be careful, don't say amen too much here today on his negative attitude towards work, because I'll just tip you off. That's not the right attitude to have, okay? Among other things, in fact, everything else in his life, the preacher king found work to be vanity and striving after the wind. And this is the next topic that he moves on to. Again, as we are here at the beginning of Ecclesiastes, we see Solomon on this quest to find meaning in life. We find this new subject addressed in Ecclesiastes chapter 2, beginning in verse 18, and I invite you to join me there in God's Word this morning. As you're finding your way there, let's just recall where we left off, and I'll be very brief in this summary. When the preacher began his mission to discover meaning in life, what did he start with? He started with wisdom. He thought, certainly, this is the solution for finding out the purpose and meaning for one's existence on planet Earth. Well, he found out it wasn't the solution, so he moved on to morality. He thought, well, maybe the meaning in life is just discerning, being able to discern what is right and wrong. And yet, like wisdom, he found out morality wasn't the solution either. In fact, it, like wisdom, only increased vexation of his spirit. And so after his morality quest, he more or less threw up his hands and he said, "What does it matter anymore? Who cares? I might as well indulge my flesh." And so you remember, he pursued hedonism for all he was worth. He approached life for that phase of his life this way. If it feels good, I'm going to do it, and I'm going to do it to the max. And so he dedicated himself to this pursuit, a pursuit that he thought would be the highway to happiness. And so he indulged himself with much wine and women and great songs and good food and luxurious possessions and entertainment and singers, and he had servants waiting on him hand and foot. He drunk all of this in deeply, all of the worldly pleasures. But in the end, none of them fully quenched his thirst for satisfaction. Instead of drinking out of a glass of water that would refresh him, it was as if he was drinking from a sand bucket. And the more he drank, the more parched he was for purpose in his life. And so as we studied last Lord's Day, Solomon said, you remember, in great frustration, "Come on, it's got to be back at wisdom. It's got to be back there. I must have missed something. I need to go back and scrutinize wisdom a little more carefully. And when I do, I need to slightly adjust my perspective. I need to come at it from a slightly different angle. And then I'll see that wisdom indeed is the true answer." Now, of course, as we've looked at wisdom in the past, you remember, we're not talking about wisdom from God, but we're talking about the wisdom of man, the best that human rationale can offer. And so he takes a second look at man's wisdom, but he comes at it from a slightly different angle. In this second look at wisdom, he compares it to mad folly, madness and folly. And he compares it in light of certain death. And what does he come up with? Wisdom still is not the answer. He says we're still going to die. And so what's the purpose of having wisdom even in life? That was his question. Sure, wisdom can help you navigate through life a little more successfully. Sure, wisdom makes life work better. But in the end, the wise man and the fool both die, so who cares? What difference does it make? Answer, none. And therefore, as we saw last time, chapter 2, verse 17, he said this, I hate life. Not just his own life, but all life. He would hate your life for you. That's how much he hated life. He saw all of human existence as futility, as vanity, as worthless, serving no purpose whatsoever. I hate life, he says. And today he's going to more or less say, and one of the things I hate most about life is work. Again, don't say amen. Okay. This is useless as well. And this brings us to our text for this morning. Let's hear from Solomon himself, beginning in verse 18 of chapter 2. He writes, then I hated all my labor in which I had toiled under the sun, because I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will rule over all my labor in which I toiled, in which I have sown myself wise under the sun. This also is vanity. Therefore I turned my heart and despaired of all the labor in which I had toiled under the sun. For there is a man whose labor is with wisdom, knowledge, and skill. Yet he must leave his heritage to a man who has not labored for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. And what has man for all his labor and for the striving of his heart with which he has toiled under the sun? For all his days are sorrowful and his work burdensome. Even in the night his heart takes no rest. This also is vanity. Nothing is better for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that his soul should enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw was from the hand of God. For who can eat or who can have enjoyment more than I? For God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in his sight. But to the sinner he gives the work of gathering and collecting, that he may give to him who is good before God. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. In sum, these words by Solomon are basically saying this. Because death renders work meaningless, endeavoring for meaning through work apart from God is futile and frustrating. Now, in verses 18 through 23, we're going to see three main reasons why Solomon concludes this, why he is disgusted by work, why he sees it as so futile and frustrating. And then when we get to verses 24 through 26, we're going to see him turn the corner. But we'll talk about that when we get there. For now, let's begin looking at these three reasons for hating work. And you'll see that they kind of build on one another, and they build in a heightening hatred. First of all, verse 18. Work is futile and frustrating because we have to leave behind its fruit. Verse 18. Then I hated all my labor in which I had toiled under the sun, because I must leave it to the man who will come after me. Now, as we start off, let's just clarify this one point, because we have already seen Solomon use the words toil and labor. We've got to understand, as he uses that word, toil and labor, he uses them in different ways depending on the context. Before, we have seen him use it in terms of a person struggling with, wrestling through the purpose, the meaning for life. That was him. That was one use of toil. But at other times in Ecclesiastes, as we see here in verse 18, toil and labor refers to what? It refers to just what you typically think of in terms of work, your daily work task. Day after day, year after year, this is what we do, right? Decade after decade, we work in order to keep a roof over our head, clothes on our back, food on the table, and toys in our hand. But Solomon asked, for what? For what purpose? All the food, all the houses, all the cars, clothes, and toys will be left behind. You've heard it many times before, I'm sure. There is no U-Haul that you can hitch onto the back of your hearse. A Jewish proverb says it perhaps even better. There are no pockets in shrouds. But what's sad is many people ignore this reality. And this is why they work themselves weary. Work and work and work their whole lives. But for what? And you know what the answer to that is? It's this. They work themselves weary for meaning. For a sense of significance. To feel like they matter. That they have a purpose for their existence. We got to understand the way many people, and even many Christians, are tempted to view work is this way. It is a matter of getting stuff, but it's not only a matter of getting stuff. You work, yes, to get stuff, to enjoy comforts and luxuries that your possessions give you, but you want something more out of your possessions. You want something more out of your wealth. There's a bigger reason for working so hard throughout life. Yes, we want the paycheck and all the perks that come from that, but those things we buy with that paycheck are a means to get what we really want. And what is that? Significance. A sense of worth, of value, of purpose and meaning in life. Money will get you a house, it will get you a car, it will get you a boat. It will allow you to put your kid into the most prestigious of schools for their education. But let's understand, it's not so much about having those things, is it? It's about getting those things so those things can say something about you to yourself, and to have those things say something about you to other people. And what do you want those things to say? You want them to say this about you. Look, look how hard I have worked. Look at all that I have earned and accomplished. This means I have wealth. And this is why these things are often called what? Status symbols. We want these things to give us a status as a significant person. But we got to understand this is vain thinking, because such thoughts are seeking status and approval in things apart from God. This is vanity. One writer for the Wall Street Journal put it well. It says, money is an article which may be used as a universal passport to everywhere except heaven, and as a universal provider of everything except happiness. Work and wealth can't give you happiness because it can't give you meaning. Apart from God, work, however fulfilling you may feel that it really is, cannot fully satisfy you, because you have a dying thirst to matter. And it just can't do that. It can't give you that value. Now, let's understand here, and this is very important. Work, in and of itself, is good, right? It has been ordained of God. Do we understand, before Adam fell, he worked? He kept up the Garden of Eden. This is before the fall. And so we know that work, in and of itself, is good. The problem is not with work. The problem is how people try to use work. They corrupt work in a way that God never intended. And what is that way? They try to have a sense of meaning from their work. So let's understand, Solomon's frustration here isn't with work itself. In fact, we already learned that he enjoyed doing projects. He found joy in that. His frustration wasn't in not getting enough return, because we know he got plenty of return from his work, right? His frustration is that work cannot fulfill man's deepest yearnings for identity. He says, I poured my life into my work, and yet it left me more and more empty. Solomon rightly points out that sinners expect work to give them a sense of purpose in life, and this is where they go wrong. In fact, this is such a common problem. One of the first questions people ask each other when they first meet each other is what? So what do you do? What do you do for a living? What do you do for work? Why is it people ask that question when they first meet each other? Because their work is how they define themselves and how they define other people. And so people identify themselves as a firefighter, as a salesman, as a teacher, as an executive, as a pastor, as an accountant, as a stay-at-home mom, etc., etc. Now, all of those jobs, and of course we can name many more, are completely legitimate and good in and of themselves. However, they can be corrupted when people are trying to find a sense of identity and meaning for life in those occupations or vocations, rather than finding their identity and purpose in life in God. Now, maybe this morning you're saying, okay, I think you're talking to a different person here today, Pastor. I'm not the guy who is the workaholic who is just desperately trying to find his meaning and value in life through his work. I'm on the different side of the spectrum. I just hate work. That's where I'm at. I just hate it. And that is another problem that people have as they relate to their work. Some people overvalue work. This is the workaholic. Some people undervalue work. They just see it as completely pointless in every way. Still others go to work day after day and they just absolutely resent their coworkers or resent their supervisors. Or perhaps they resent the whole corporation they work for a variety of reasons. My point is there are a lot of different wrong ways many people approach their work, their workplace, and their coworkers. But when we look at Solomon, remember, he is not just looking at his own personal work. He's looking at the whole enterprise of work throughout humanity. And the thing that he complains about the most is everything you work for to gain stuff and maintain stuff, you all lose in the end. It's all gone. And so you spend your life, your whole life, growing your savings account, collecting and gathering stuff, making a home, building a business, perhaps establishing a school, and then you die and it's all taken away. You can't take any of it. Instead, it goes to a foolish person. He didn't do any of the work to earn all that you earned through your wisdom and your hard work. And this is Solomon's second reason. Verses 19 and 20, he's basically saying work is futile and frustrating because we have to leave behind its fruit to a fool. Again, those verses. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool, yet he will rule over all my labor in which I toiled and in which I have shown myself wise under the sun. This also is vanity. Therefore I turned my heart and despaired of all the labor in which I had toiled under the sun. So the preacher king says, you labor hard throughout your whole life. You end up accumulating all this stuff. And in the end, it's very possible it's all going to go to some fool. Someone who's just going to blow it all. Now, there is a chance it could go to somebody wise, but given enough time, that money is going to end up, because the world is full of so many fools, eventually it's probably going to end up in the hand of the fool who is just going to be totally profligate with it. I mean, even if the person who immediately inherits your wealth is wise, it's eventually going to get to a fool. Think about it like this. Let's say you give your kids a vast inheritance. And let's say, just for argument's sake, they actually are quite wise with the money that you have given them. In fact, they make your wealth grow. But then they give that wealth, at the end of their life, to their kids, your grandkids, and they blow it. It eventually got to a fool. And if not them, their kids, or their kids after them. The point is, it seems pretty certain at some point all that you work so hard to accumulate will go to a fool. And think about this, even if it doesn't, let's say you just have this amazing progeny, and you've just got this long line of descendants that are just very wise with money, and let's say they make your wealth grow from here on out. Who cares? Who cares? You're not around to enjoy it. You did all this work and you can't even enjoy it anymore. Your descendants, or someone else you give your money to, didn't earn it, and they don't deserve it. They weren't the ones who worked so hard for it. You did, and yet you can't enjoy the reward of your own labor. I mean, it's bad enough you have to leave your wealth behind that you've worked so hard for, but now you may have to leave it to a person who's going to do all the wrong things with the money that you've given them and tear down everything you have built. And although Solomon didn't realize it at the time when he wrote Ecclesiastes, this is exactly what his son Rehoboam would do. Everything he had worked so hard for, 40 years he built up this premier nation, Israel, United Kingdom, a great kingdom. Only took a few months for his son Rehoboam just to tear it to shreds. 10/12 of his kingdom was lost. Folks, no matter how hard you may try to demonstrate to your children what it is to be a wise steward, no matter how careful you are in writing your will to prevent future misuse of your money, when people are involved, eventually those people are going to find a way to blow it for your money for you. And Solomon realized this, and this is why he says in verse 20, I despaired of all the labor I had done. Why did he despair? Because all work is vain if it is done apart from God. If it's not done for His glory, it is useless. Now, we know from the New Testament this stands in direct contrast, and I'm going to elaborate more on this later. But this stands in direct contrast to what we see in the New Testament when Paul writes this in 1 Corinthians 15, My beloved brothers, be steadfast and unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your labor is not in vain. So if your labor is done for the Lord ultimately, and by that I don't just mean doing ministry in a church. By that I mean work in your workplace. If you do it ultimately for the Lord, then understand it is not in vain. It will be of eternal reward. You see, the Christian understands there's no difference between the secular and the sacred. All ground is holy ground, every bush a burning bush. And this is the big difference. It's a difference of perspective. If you're looking at all things under the sun, then yes, of course, like Solomon, you're going to conclude, it's a waste. It's all vanity. But if you're looking at things from the above the sun perspective, from God's perspective, and you work for God's glory ultimately, and you're doing whatever you do, day in and day out, for Him. Not even for yourself or for other people, but for Him. Then you know that it is not vain, but it is of eternal value. Again, let me make this very clear. We're not just talking about doing ministry in a church. I'm talking about your work. I'm talking about as you write up reports, as you operate a drill, as you conduct reviews or have meetings, all these things can be done in a God-glorifying way, and when they are, there is eternal fruit, and it is not in vain. You know, one of the most helpful things that happened in the Reformation was this truth that I'm talking about right now. The Reformers, and of course later the Puritans, helped recover the idea that all work is sacred. The sanctity of work, and of course, this was different than from what Rome was teaching, which made this very sharp dichotomy between the secular and the sacred. But we've got to understand, any legitimate form of work is holy work if it is done for God and for His glory. In fact, Martin Luther would argue the housewife or the shoekeeper who labored for the Lord in their work was engaged in holier work than the work done by nuns and priests and monks and clergymen who labored for themselves. He writes along these lines, "When a maid cooks and cleans and does other housework, because God's command is there, even such a small work must be praised as a service of God, far surpassing the holiness and asceticism of all monks and nuns." So the question we got to ask ourselves is, where are we looking then? Where are we seeking fruit for our labor? What kind of seed are you planting in any type of work, in the home, in your workplace, in the church? If you're only looking at life under the sun, then you're going to conclude just like Solomon, it's all vanity. All the fruit of your labor is going to be possessed by another after you. It eventually will be a fool who takes hold of it all. But if you do it for the Lord, it's of eternal value. Well, Solomon continues on. To add insult to injury, he gives a third reason why work is futile and frustrating. He basically says you can't even fully enjoy the fruit of your labor right here and now. You won't have it when you die, and if the truth be told, you don't even have it completely right now. You don't. You may think you do, but you don't. You can't enjoy your wealth, the reward of your work, as you should, not to its fullest now. This is our third point. Work is futile and frustrating because we have to leave behind its fruit to a fool, and we can't even enjoy it now. Verses 21 through 23. "For there is a man whose labor is with wisdom, knowledge, and skill. Yet he must leave his heritage to a man who has not labored for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. For what has man for all his labor and for the striving of his heart with which he has toiled under the sun? For all his days are sorrowful and his work burdensome. Even in the night his heart takes no rest. This also is vanity." Basically, he's saying if all we do in our lives is work and work and work and work, and all we think about is gaining, gaining, gaining from our work, and then we worry, worry, worry about what's going to happen to all of our wealth once we're gone, we're going to have miserable lives. That's what he's saying. Our days are going to be filled with sorrow, and work is going to be burdensome to us. What's the point in this? To spend days in travail and grief and sleepless nights, and yet none of our heirs have to experience all this because they are just given it all. Is this what it's all about? Is this what life is really all about? It'd be ridiculous to say that. It's not what it's all about. The preacher King is taking his argument here to a whole new level. You know what he's really saying here? He's saying here, work is worse than useless. It's not only useless, it's worse than that. It's an injustice. It's unfair. It's unfair that someone else should benefit from all of my labor and what I have tried so hard through blood, sweat, and tears to build. It's unfair that they should have this with no work. Verse 21, he says, "A man can labor with wisdom," that is, a practical know-how. "He can be a man who labors with knowledge. He has the needed information to do his job. And he can do it with skill. He has expertise. Not everybody can do what he does in his work. But he asks the question, for what? What's the reward of his labor? Verse 23, here's his reward. "His life is filled with sorrow and vexation from his work." You can work all day long. You can feel worn down in your mind and in your body and in your spirit and in your emotions, but it doesn't even stop there, does it? Solomon says you'll lose sleep because of your work. You'll find yourself anxious because you feel like you can't provide enough for your family. Or perhaps at other times you'll feel anxious and lose sleep because you feel like you're not going to meet the deadlines that are imposed upon you by your boss. You don't feel like you can get all the work done. Or perhaps you dread going to work because you think of that personnel conflict that's always there. And so at night, you still feel like you're on the clock. Why? Because you can't turn off your emotions. And this wearisomeness, he says, continues day and night. And at last, says verse 23, all your days, and in the end, you have very little to show for all of your efforts. Answer this question to yourself. Is that how you feel about your work? Does that describe, at least in part, your approach to work, your mindset for work? If so, that is a sure sign that you are probably trying to find your meaning in work, your identity in work, and that is vain because you are overburdening yourself to lay up treasures on earth instead of heaven. Work apart from God at its center will not give us meaning in life, but sorrow and vexation and leave us empty. However, when we come to verse 24 through 26, we see this dramatic turn by Solomon, don't we? And basically what he's saying here is this: work is fulfilling when God fills every aspect of our lives, including work. Let me read this from the NASB for clarity's sake, verses 24 and 25. There's nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I have seen, that it is from the hand of God. Who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him? Now, these verses here are the first of six conclusions that we're going to see in our study throughout Ecclesiastes. And in each one of these conclusions, he's going to be emphasizing the importance of seeing life as a gift from God and enjoying it within his will. And so now we have this sort of unexpected turn in Solomon, don't we? It's a sort of oasis of optimism in a desert of despair. A theologian, Michael Eaton, remarks here, having experienced the bankruptcy of our pretended autonomy, the preacher now points to the God who occupies the heavenly realm and to the life of faith in him. So these verses, for the first time, give us something positive. They're the first truly positive words that we find in Ecclesiastes, as if the sun rays are finally starting to peek through the dark clouds, the dreary clouds of Solomon's worldview. It seems that he is now beginning to see the difference in living life with God as opposed to life without God. And we've got to see this in Ecclesiastes. It's very important because if we don't see these rays of hope, we're going to conclude that the only thing Solomon is saying is all of life is vanity. And most certainly that is his message throughout this book, but it's not the only message he gives. He also says there can be joy in our life as we receive it as a blessing from his hand, as we see life as a gift, and as we see God at the center of all meaning for our lives. And so we've got to see both claims here. Yes, life is vanity, and yet joy is possible with God. The tensions have got to be held there as you read Ecclesiastes. Tensions that, in a way, kind of sound like Charles Dickens in the opening lines of A Tale of Two Cities. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. We had everything before us. We had nothing before us. And this is the way Solomon talks. It's a recognition that we live in a world filled with tensions. And we have got to understand that. We live in a world of tensions. This world has been cursed by sin. And yet at the same time, God created it. And when he did, he said it was very good. He created it as good. He even in flesh visited it in order to redeem it. And so we've got to understand, in this world, we will both experience sorrow, and if we are a Christian, true joy. It's interesting what Solomon does there in verse 24. He embraces some activities that previously he rejected as failing to give meaning in life. He concluded earlier that work and the pleasures of food, drink, could not satisfy his heart. But now he is saying he finds delight in these things, finds delight in work, in food, in drink. So what has happened? What has made the difference? What is the difference between joy and sorrow, between emptiness and fulfillment? The answer is God. It is God. This is what has been absent from the thinking of Solomon and why he has felt such emptiness ongoing in his life. It's why it's been so dark and dreary for him. But now he is speaking in terms of joy. Why? Because now God is in the picture. Now, as verse 24 says, the preacher enjoys food and drink as gifts from the hand of God. What's the difference? He is no longer approaching life as the pleasures I've got to take for myself, but rather the pleasures I receive as a gift from the hand of the Almighty. He started to realize earthly pleasures are gifts to be received from God. Did he recognize they have limitations? Oh yes, of course. Did he recognize that they could never provide eternal satisfaction? Yes, of course. But he also understood, and we must understand, legitimate enjoyment of legitimate things of this world actually encourage us to worship God. And that includes our work. When we see earthly delights as gifts from God, we can give him thanks. And as we do, God is glorified. He is magnified in our eyes and before the eyes of others. Ray Stedman writes, "Isn't it strange? The more you run after life, panting after every pleasure, the less you find. But the more you take life as a gift from God's hand, responding in thankful gratitude for the delight of the moment, the more that seems to come to you." And we've got to understand that's true about all things, including work. It was given to us to be received as a gift from God. Do we recognize, just like man's image has been marred, so too has work? Yes, work has been cursed. And yet, there is a basic goodness to work. Again, this comes from our Creator. We are the image bearers of God. A God, we must remember, is a working God. He is still working. Constantly working. And therefore we know that work in and of itself is a very good thing. God does it all the time. And so as redeemed image bearers, Christians can find pleasure and ever increasing pleasure in work itself. That is possible. You say it's impossible. No, it's possible. How so? It's possible because redemption is progressively being reversed. Or rather, redemption is progressing in our lives, and it is reversing the curse, which includes the curse of work. And so the closer and closer we draw to the Lord and think as He thinks, the closer we get to His original design in creation, and that includes a creation view of work as good. When we work, let's understand, believer, we can find God's pleasure so long as we are thinking, and here's the key, so long as we are thinking above the sun and not under the sun. So long as we are working for God and His glory in a way pleasing to Him rather than just working for ourselves. Why is your work so dreary? Why is it so laborious and boring? It's because you only see it as for yourself. And therefore, all your work is a sowing into death. It is selfish sin rather than a sowing into life, because it is sowing into the glory of God. Whatever our job may be, we got to understand our ultimate boss, our manager, or CEO is not that guy you answer to on Monday morning. It's the Lord God. He is your boss. Our work as believers is done under the sun, S-O-N, not just under the sun, S-U-N. Therefore, Paul writes, "Whatever you do, do it heartily as to the Lord and not to men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the reward of the inheritance, for you serve the Lord Christ." It's a very helpful phrase Paul uses there when he says, "From the Lord you will receive the reward." It's helpful because it takes us back to the key issue that we looked at earlier. The question was this: what does the worker profit from all his labor? What does he profit from all his labor? Well, if you leave God out, nothing. Do you go to work and labor and leave God out? Then what you're doing is vanity. It's useless. It's of no profit. But when we bring God back into the picture, as Solomon did, he found his reward. Verse 26, "For God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in his sight. But to the sinner he gives the work of gathering and collecting, that he may give to him who is good before God. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind." Now in this verse, the preacher King is distinguishing between two types of people. One person is the person who is under the grace and mercy of God, and the other person is still persisting in their sin. And so Solomon calls that person the sinner. This is the person that you can basically say leaves God out. Now, the first group of people who please God, they're described as what? They're described as thankful recipients of God's blessings. And what does God give them? He gives them wisdom. And now we see a change in the kind of wisdom we're talking about, right? What kind of wisdom are we talking about here? We're talking about divine wisdom now, not just human wisdom. And to this, God also gives knowledge and true spiritual joy. Now, I think it's very important to understand these people who are pleasing to God are so because they've been blessed by God. And because they are, and because they live for God's pleasure, it says they're going to be greatly rewarded with many blessings that God, by the way, delights in giving them. But what is the situation for the impenitent sinner? It's exact opposite. Nothing is of value. Everything is lost. It's all vanity. Why? Because of his depravity. Because of his depravity, all of his work is futile. It's frustrating. His whole life, verse 26 says, is given to what? To the work of gathering and collecting. He just keeps accumulating, just keeps piling things up. He keeps acquiring goods. But in the end, he does what? He leaves it all behind. And it's very interesting what it says here in verse 26. Who does he leave it behind to? To the righteous. And Solomon says, this makes the sinner's life vanity. And we see this sometimes in a physical sense. We obviously see it in Scripture. For example, you see the Canaanites losing all their land to who? To God's people, the Israelites. But we see this even today in certain situations where perhaps property or wealth in great irony is taken away from the wicked and given to the righteous. And we rejoice in those times. But we understand it doesn't always happen that way, right? It doesn't always happen in a physical sense. In fact, it's probably more correct to say it usually doesn't happen that way, because part of the futility of living in this fallen world is that the righteous suffer, but the wicked just seem to keep on prospering. And so let's understand it's not always this way in a physical sense, on earth anyway. It's usually more in a spiritual sense. But we know this, in the end, at the end of the ages, what's going to happen? The meek will inherit the earth, just as Jesus promised. In his time and according to his sovereign justice, God will give to his people what sinners have been gathering. As Jesus said, to everyone who has, more will be given. But as for the one who has nothing, even what he has will be taken away. That's a great promise. But what are we supposed to think until that day? Well, if we are believers, we are to think that work can be enjoyed. That we can enjoy the fruit of our work and work itself. You say, but Pastor, I just have such a hard time thinking in that category. There's a reason for that. The reason is simply this. You're thinking under the sun. And you've got to change your perspective to above the sun. You need to repent. Joy from your work isn't going to come when you finally get the amount of money you think you're worth being paid. It's not going to happen when you have the right employer or you finally find the right profession. Joy from your work is going to come when you start seeing your work, wherever you're at right now, as a gift from God to you. To see your work through the lens of the gospel. Okay, well, what perspective will that give? What does the gospel say to us about work? Well, for starters, here's what the gospel says about work. It says Jesus did all of the hardest work. He did all the hard work for your salvation already. That's where your thinking about work has got to start. That Christ did all the hard work for my salvation already. Throughout his life, he always perfectly did the hard work of doing the Father's will. He said, "My food is to do the will of him who sent me and to accomplish his work." And of course, the crowning achievement of all his work, the hardest part of his work on earth was his cross work. Where on Calvary, he bore the full weight of our sin unto death, that we may be rescued from death. This is what theologians refer to as the finished what? Work of Christ. But let's understand. Christ continues to work. Not in terms of making up some deficiency in his atonement, certainly not. But he works through the ministry of his church. He works through us. We who are, in a sense, his visible hands and his feet. And you know what that means? That means we are given the tremendous privilege of sharing in his glorious current work. And I think we understand, yes, that work includes doing ministry, like singing praises to God, helping out one's neighbor, loving others, praying, preaching, giving, all these things. But again, let's also understand, we share in his glorious work by doing our ordinary work task in a way that glorifies him. This too is kingdom work. Again, let me quote Luther on this score. "The entire world should be full of service to God. Not only the churches, but also the home, the kitchen, the cellar, the workshop, and the field." So whatever vocation God has placed you in, and that's a carefully chosen word, vocation, because that's what it is. It is a calling from God on your life, wherever he has placed you. Whatever vocation God has placed you in, you can do it for God's glory and thereby find joy in it. If you're not finding joy in it, then you need to preach the gospel afresh to you. Jesus did all the work necessary for my biggest problem. And what problem is that? My sin and deserving condemnation. And that changes my perspective on everything, including my work and how I approach it. So whatever you do, businessman, housewife, factory worker, executive, engineer, be busy about it for the Lord and not yourself. Paul encourages us, "Therefore, my beloved brothers, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain." Let's bow our heads for a word of prayer.